Hi, I'm Linda and I'm an alcoholic. It's probably the most important thing I need to know about myself is that I'm an alcoholic. And Billy, thank you for having me here. It's always an honor to speak. And as you can tell, I'm probably not from the South. I get sober in Boston, born and raised in Massachusetts. And speaker meetings is all we do. And I miss them. I miss speaking, telling my story. And one of the things that the difference for me is that I sort of forget who I am when I don't tell my story in its entirety. And that would happen 3 or 4 times a week in Massachusetts because those are the meetings we would do when we travel all over the state. So thank you, Billy. I'm going to tell you a little bit about me as a kid. Not that it helped. It's not like makes me alcoholic, but this is the kind of kid I was. I was a kid full of fear, you know, right from jump for no apparent reason. I would hide behind my mom's skirt. I was terribly shy. I know it's hard to believe if you'd met me today. But I was an extremely, you know, shy child, and I was a goody-goody because I wanted to, you know, be liked, except I didn't know that then, and I was a terrible tattletale, which made it problematic for my poor brother that couldn't do a blessed thing right, and he's one of us as well. And I was one of these kids that just said whatever she was thinking because I didn't know there was anything wrong with that. And I'll just give you this one quick story that my mom told me years ago. I'm about 8 years old, you know, my mom and dad were very open about anything that was going on in the home, and so my mom had, you know, she'd take a pill every night, and I asked her what it was, and she told me it was birth control. I'm like, okay, she explains what this is to me. I go across the street to play with my neighbor, you know, my friend, who really didn't like me anyway, and I see her mother, and she's pregnant, and this is the kind of kid I am. And I say to this woman, I was like, you know, if you don't want to be pregnant, there's a pill you can take. And you won't have to get pregnant. And not knowing anything's wrong with it. So, you know, some people call that precocious. Some people say that's just ridiculous. And but I just didn't know. So I was always sort of really separate from people. Again, that doesn't make me alcoholic. It just makes me have this problem with relating to people and not knowing. I just couldn't make these bonds and always feeling on the outside looking in. And so my life, takes off, and also one of the things you need to know about me is if I don't play well with others, never did, from the day I came out. If you didn't want to play exactly what I wanted to play, the way I wanted to play it, I took my marbles and went home, and I was perfectly fine with that, and I did that at a very young age. So consequently, I played alone a lot, didn't know how to, you know, give and take, and it's been a problem in my adulthood. I'm trying to learn that, how to play well with others, and so I'm a kid that comes along that's not really getting along with a lot of kids, don't have a lot of friends, and don't know exactly why. And, you know, I am just going to keep it brief because in the book it says in a general way what my life was like, what it's like now, and what happened to me, or what happened to me and what it's like now. And all you really need to know is I didn't drink much as a teenager. I drank a little at 16. You know, at 16 it was a magic age for me. You know, I could date. I could get in a car with a boy. I could wear makeup. I could put pantyhose on, like that was a big deal in the day. And so I had my first boyfriend at 16, and I could go out with kids in a group, but I couldn't go out alone. And they had said, have you ever been drunk? And I had never been drunk. And they found that amazing. At 16, I had never been drunk. So they set out to remedy this situation for me. And they introduced me to tango. I get terribly drunk and vomit everywhere, and it wasn't like I want to do that again. That was not my experience with that. And I didn't drink much after that. I didn't like the taste of alcohol. My friends kind of dabbled. I might, you know, take a couple swigs off Southern Comfort. But around 18, I had a significant loss in my life. And I thought I met the man I was going to marry. My mom thought, and my dad thought. They loved him. I loved him. And it didn't come to be. And that's just the way that was. And so what happened at that point, it was such a significant loss. I had no idea how to handle that. And I was just devastated. And I had a friend, my best childhood friend in you know, high school. And she was always dating the older boys. And this boy was, you know, drinking at a bar. And, you know, we were 18 at the time. And we couldn't drink there. But they would let us go in there. And I found bar rooms. Now, I love bar rooms. Love bar rooms. Never drank at home. Never drank at barbecues. I was in a bar from the minute it opened till the time it closed, if I could be in a bar room. Didn't drink at home. Don't like going to parties. Don't like drinking at a picnic. And one of the things I found about bar rooms is it was a great distraction for me. Like, the people and the craziness and the nonsense and all the chatter in my head stopped. Soon after that, I found booze, and booze started to work for me. And things started to get a little bit crazy. So At 25, the rest is, you know, somewhere around 21, 22, I have no idea. I get my first drunk driving. I'm horrified. I'm a nice girl, you know, straight-A student, graduate high school, never get into trouble. And I had been a habitual drunk driver for years, and my mother hated that more than anything in the world. My mother found that abhorrent, that I would drive drunk on a regular basis. And when I get arrested, she would tell me, and when I got arrested, she told me that she wouldn't go with me to court, and I was devastated. Like, I was little. I don't even know if I was old enough to drink. And I was working in Boston, and there was this woman that was sort of like my mom, and she came with me to court. Like, I had no idea how any of that worked, and I was just mortified, just absolutely mortified. And I did it all wrong. And anyway, my life progresses, and at 25, I pick up my second drunk drive, and so it's 1987. I'm 25 years old. I get my second drunk driving right after my birthday, somewhere in March, and in between that time, I had been let go a lot. I should have been arrested a lot of times, but the police let me go. And so part of my probation and all this other stuff through the Massachusetts courts are things like I have probation. I have to go to drunk school for 2 weeks, my first incarceration in some sort of hospital, a Massachusetts treatment facility run by the state to educate me about alcoholism. I don't really want to be there. I was supposed to go in August. They do it once a month for women. I was supposed to go in August, and you're not supposed to show up intoxicated. It's the only thing they ask you not to do. The night before was my best childhood high school friend's wedding. What were the chances I wasn't going to drink? Not only did I drink, I ruined her wedding. I caused this huge scene. I pass out on the garage floor. I wake up in a bed. I say to her, like, and her husband carried me off the floor into a bed, and I was supposed to go that morning to this drunk school, and I'm highly intoxicated. She's off on her honeymoon. She makes arrangements for somebody to take me. I get there, staggering, and they coming out of every pore, and they're like, they give me this litmus paper, and they're like, we just put that in your mouth for a minute, and it just was off the charts. And they're like, we can't take you. You're drunk. And for me, that meant incarceration. Now, like, that terrified me. I'd never been incarcerated. They're talking about if you don't show up and you don't follow these, it's incarceration. And I was terrified. And of course, I don't tell anybody, so I drag my little suitcase. I go off, and it's a fair distance from my home, and I start thumbing, and I get a ride, and I come to my mom's house, because I'm living at my mom's house, and my mom's like, what are you doing here? This is in August of 87. I'm like, I'm drunk. They wouldn't take me, and she just is like, oh, dear God. So in September, I have to go again, and I go, and I don't show up drunk, because I don't have a wedding, and I learned some things there, and some of the things I learned is I took all their stupid little tests, probably like the AA questionnaire, and it said I was in middle stages alcoholism. That didn't really mean anything to me. I didn't really care. I didn't really care that you had a problem with your drinking, because I still hadn't had a problem with my drinking. You know, I was okay with my drinking. It was not, and I didn't really care that you had a problem with my drinking. And, you know, they had AA come in. It was, and back then, it was an hour and a half. It was the longest hour and a half of my life. You know, I'd count the tiles. I'd, you know, hit the boy next to me. I'd tap my foot. If there's a paper on the thing, I'd read it. And I was like, and I remember thinking, like, how are these, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but this is my thought. How are these idiots up here talking about, are going to save my life? I mean, that's just foolish, And and that was what I took away from that. And the only other thing that was really significant was, there was a young boy that had to come in that was 17 that had killed his best friend driving drunk. And Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, part of his probation was he had to come to these programs and tell his story about how he had killed his best friend at the age of 17. I remember the story. It had an impact. Did it change the fact that I left that facility and didn't drive drunk? No, it didn't. And so I tried not to drink after I left that facility. I lasted, I want to say 3 days, maybe 48 hours, and I was crazy. And what alcohol did for me, it wasn't like I was 10 feet tall, pretty, or danced better, but it stopped the chatter in my head. Like, there was so much noise in my head all the time driving me. I was crazy. And so I used to say, nobody's meaner to me than me. And all that chatter in my head drove me to distraction. Like, I couldn't take it. And so I didn't even have to drink. I could go into a bar, wrap my hand around the glass, and you could just see all the tension. I would go, And all the tension would leave my body before I'd even bring it to my lips. Like, I just knew what was coming as soon as that hit my lips. And that was good for me. Like, that worked for a lot of years for me. And then, of course, at 25, it stopped working. So I just couldn't drink. I was irritable, restless, and discontent. You know, I was agitated. I was pacing. I was crazy. And I had one other try of trying not to drink. I was like 23, and my dad had a heart attack. I love this man more than life. And he needed to lose weight. So the deal was, I don't drink, he loses weight. Again, if I lasted 72 hours, I'm probably lying. And I looked at him and I said, I really love you, but I can't do this. I can't do this. And I didn't know that I couldn't stop drinking. Like, I could still go to work. I could still get up. I could still make a living. And my two worlds were really, really far apart still at this point. At 25, my worlds are colliding now. I can't keep them apart. I can't get up. So what happens is, you know, in September, I have some horrific event in the presence of my mom. It's like my worst event on my fifth step. It takes me, like, years to get it out. And it is what sets me on my path to getting sober. And it was so horrific for me that I moved out. And I say to my mom, I made amends to my mom. That's later down the road. But I said to my mom, I don't even remember how I got home. I don't even know what happened. Who picked me up? Like, I was just so horrified. And she's like, David came and got you. I'm like, oh, I don't know where I slept. I was just in this grayout, blackout kind of thing. And I never went back. I couldn't look at my mom. I just couldn't look at my mom. The saving grace was my dad wasn't home. It was just not the girl they had raised me to be. It was not the girl I wanted to be. It was not the thing I wanted my mother to see. And it was not what I had planned when I got up that morning. Like, none of these things that I did wasn't my plan when I got up in the morning. I didn't get up and say, I think I want to hurt you today. I think I want to sleep with your boyfriend. I think I want to drive drunk and possibly kill you. That was not my plan in the morning when I got up. You know, I had plans and I had dreams. And when alcohol came into my life, they left. And so I leave in September. December comes, and I go on a 7-day bender in Florida. I bring in the new year by myself, which I love to do, travel. And I'm not a morning drinker, except on vacation. And so I really wasn't a morning except on vacation. So I would start drinking about 10. And so a couple of significant things happened down there. Somewhere between, in my 25th year, I met this young boy. He would never tell me his age. I don't know how old he was. I don't know if he was 19 or 22, but he would never tell me. And I met him in a bar, but I knew he was younger than 21 because he had a fake license. And I really liked him. He was a nice boy. He was a nice young man. And I wasn't a nice girl. And he wanted to date, and he wanted to try to make this thing. And I'm like, oh, no, you just really don't know me. And I just wouldn't date him because I just wasn't a nice girl. And I run into him down there, like, blind drunk. I'm, like, blind drunk, and I've been drinking since 10 a.m., and I have, like, one hand over my eye trying to read the jukebox, and he's like, Linda, it's Terry, and I'm like, anyway, the long and short of that story was that whole night turns into a disaster with him, and I think in the morning he comes and says goodbye, because he was leaving, and I was leaving the following day, and I thought, like, that's the last vision this man has of me, and I really like the guy. And here I was, curled up on my hotel bedroom, like sick, so sick, you know, and I'm dying of thirst, so I drank a gallon of water, and then I feel like a washing machine, my belly's full of water, and I'm nauseous, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm curled up in the bed dying, and he leaves, and again, I'm embarrassed, again, I'm ashamed, again, this is not how I want somebody to see me or think of me, but here I am, and so I get on the plane. I almost miss it because I'm at a bar. I get on the plane. It's snowing. It's late. I get home. I can't find anybody to pick me up. I pass out at the office. In the bathroom in the office, there was a couch outside. There was an ante room before the bathroom. And I pass out on the couch. I stroll out like at 8 in the morning. And people are like, Linda. I'm like, yeah, I know. Couldn't get home. Snow. It's snowing. And I, you know, go to work. And this is what happens. The guy I'd been dating for 7 years, off and on calls, and says, what are you doing today, Linda? And I say, I can't get out of this vacation mode. And I don't know what that means. So he and I proceed on a 3-day bender. But coming here, I know that was the first time I experienced I couldn't stop drinking. I wasn't done. I was not done. And I had never experienced that in my life. And for me, my measuring stick was for alcoholism was employability. As long as I was making a good job, you know, a good living, I was paying the bills, and I was, you know, holding up my end of responsibilities, and to heck with you. This was not happening anymore. So we go on a 3-day run, and it's awful. It is awful. And I say to him on the end of my third day, you need to, and I don't go to work. This is the first. I don't call in and I don't show up. That's never happened ever. Ever. And I say to him, it's 7 in the morning, I'm like, you've got the work truck. You need to take the truck to work. I'm sick. You need to go. I'm sick. 3 days. I'm sick. He leaves. He comes back an hour later with goodies and more booze. And I'm like, oh, whatever. All right. So we go at it again. Lots of things happen that day. Not good things. And it's about 6 o'clock that night. I'd been up for days. We started again like at 7:38 in the morning. We went to the bar. I said, like, if you're going to make me drink, we're not drinking here. We're going to go to the bar that I like to drink at. And that's where we're going. And we did. And I looked at the bartender. I said, I'm going to get on the bus at 9 o'clock. And they're like, uh-huh. He's like, it's 9. All right, I'm going to get on the bus at 10 o'clock and go to work. They're like, uh-huh. It's 10:30. I never made it to work. And by 6 o'clock, some things had happened. And I remember kind of like lifting my head up off the bar stool. And this is what I thought. And this is what I said to myself. I see very separate people sitting very much alone on bar stools, and this was my future. Like, I was going to be so alone, sitting on a bar stool, all by myself. And I wanted to be married, and I wanted, you know, the 2.5 kids and 2 car, you know, the white picket fence. I had dreams. I wanted things, and this was my future. So my brother had gotten sober a couple years before me. I'm running out the door in terror, thinking, like, I got to get help. Like, I got to go. And somebody walking through the door sees me and says, are you all right? I'm like, no, I just need a ride. You got to get me out of here. Things aren't good. And I have an apartment, but my parents are out of town. You know, I just come back from Florida. They're in Europe. And so I'm going to their house so nobody can find me at my house. And so they take me to my mom's house, and I call my brother. And I say, I need help. I said, I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning, the sun is going to come up, and I am going to tell you that I have overreacted, that the night was not nearly as bad as I think it is right now. Can you please set into play things you need to do to help me? Because I know when the sun comes up, I'm going to tell you I've overreacted and things aren't that bad. Please help me. And he had sponsors and stuff because he had gotten sober in Massachusetts before he moved to, I think he was living in Florida at the time. And he hooked me up. So I'm sitting at my mom's house. And I call my dad. They're in Germany. I call Germany. And I say to my mom, when you get home, I won't be here. And my mom says, where will you be? And she goes, because I was always leaving. Like, I did a lot of geographical cures. Like, I would just get my car and take off. And my poor parents. And I was like, I'm going to go get help. I'm having problems with alcohol and drugs. And booze and drugs. And my mom was like, she's never done this. She said, talk to your father. She hands the phone to my father. And I'm like, Dad, I'm in trouble. I'm having trouble. And my dad knew I was in trouble, but my dad thought, I remember him, he said, she'll outgrow this. This is just a phase. Those were his exact words. I'm like, Dad, I'm having trouble with drugs and booze, and I need help. You know, when you get home, I'll be in treatment. And he said, we'll be home tomorrow. Can you please wait for us? And I said, okay. So, again, I'm at my parents' house, and my brother went to a 28-day fancy Newport, Rhode Island, fancy rehab. I want to go to 28 days Edge Hill, fancy rehab. I have my recovery all laid out for me. I have this vision of how I want to get sober. My insurance company doesn't want to pay. They say I'm not that bad. I should go outpatient. And I was like, oh, no, that's not what I want. I want a fancy rehab. And so I'm waiting for my parents to get home, and I'm at my mom's house, and the phone rings, and I don't think it's going to be anybody from me because I have my own apartment, and I have my own phone at my own apartment. I didn't have a cell phone, but I have my own apartment. And it was my boss, who I love more than life, and he said, Linda. And there was a pause just like that. And I wanted to die, and I started to cry. And I can remember what it feels like. And I said, he says, I think you owe me an explanation. And I said, I'm having trouble with booze and alcohol, and I'm going to get help tomorrow. I'm waiting for my dad and my mom to get home. They asked me to wait. And that was the first time I told somebody other than myself, I didn't mind being an alcoholic. And my parents probably knew I was alcoholic, although my dad thought it was a phase, out loud that I needed help. And so he said, what do you want to do? And I, you know, when I don't know and I'm afraid, I just get flippant. And I said, might as well go on while I was drunk because I won't be able to drink again. He's like, Linda. I'm like, I'd really like to come into work. I mean, my parents don't get through customs till probably, they get in at 6, they probably won't get through customs, they probably won't get home till 8 or 8:30. So he said, you come to work, you get my affairs in order, and we'll talk. you go to work, and he says to me, remember, now this is the end of my drinking. I am miserable at work. I'm up every night drinking until 6 or 7 in the morning. I might sleep an hour. I get on the bus. I go to work. By 11 o'clock, I go in. I stink. I remember one time I was across from him, and he's like, Christ, Linda. I'm like, I know. You're just coming off me. So, by 11 o'clock, I'm sick, and I don't feel good, and I go out for lunch, have a couple, and I'm not really nice to the people, the women I work with, you know, and my peers and my colleagues. I'm not very nice and not really well-liked in the firm except by my boss. My boss loves me, which is a mystery. And he said, if you stay sober, I will let you come back to your job. I was like, really? He's like, I will keep your job if you can stay sober. And I said, okay. So I went home and I talked to my parents. And I said to my parents, I want this fancy-dancy thing. And they won't pay for it. They want me to go to outpatient. And, Mom, I can't do outpatient. I would be so sick sometime coming from work. And I swear to you on God, I would say, I'm going to go home. And it was like automatic pilot. I would be driving. I'm going home, and I'm in front of the bar. I'm like, it's like I'd have this blackout, this blank space. And I'm like, I'm in front of the bar again. And that was not my intent. I'm sick. I don't feel good. I haven't slept in days. Here I am again. And I'm like, well, I'm just going to go in for one. I never really said one. But I was, I'm here. I might as well go in. It would start this vicious cycle. So I said to my mom, look, I know that I need an adult timeout. Like, I cannot come into Alcoholics Anonymous and get it. I just know I can't. I'm not that girl. I'm not that girl. And I had come to Alcoholics Anonymous after my second drunk driving somewhere in the spring of 87. So now we're in January of 88, and I'm getting sober. But in the spring of 87, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a dark, dingy hall. I sat in the back. I cried. People gave me a book. They gave me a bumper sticker. I was horrified. And they were so kind, and I'm sobbing. Like, tears are just streaming down my face. And I'm always like, yeah. This is a gross overreaction. Like, AA is not it for me. So I walked out and proceeded for another nine months, and life got worse. So I had checked you guys out, but you were not appealing. And I came into AA, and I heard this guy say that at one point the cure was worse than the disease, and that's how I felt about AA. The cure for coming here for my alcoholism was worse than being drunk. So I went out for another 9 months, and God made sure that I might rethink that. And my parents get home, and my dad's just a working-class Joe. They don't have a lot of money. I mean, they have $4,000 or $5,000 in a savings account. My dad works really hard. Whatever. So they say to me, we can't pay for 28 days, but we can put you in for 14. So I had to do 3 days, so I was in there for 17, and they paid, and it just broke my heart because it was all they had. Now, let me tell you, we are not the best bet. Most of the time, we fail, and money is a big thing for me. It takes a long time to make money, and to take my parents' money was tough. So I went to this place called Gosnell that was on the Cape, and I'll never forget, they take me for my last supper, and we're going to lunch before I have to check into this treatment facility. And it was a gin mill. My dad loves gin mills. He loves to eat gin mills. And all I can see are the bottles of booze across the wall, the creme de menthe and the bourbons and the colors and the vodkas. And I'm thinking, like, okay, I've overreacted here. And now I'm full of fear. Not only I'm terrified. I am beyond terrified. And I'm thinking, like, oh, man, I need to back this up. And I have this dialogue going on in my head, like, I can't do this. I'm going to fail. What am I going to do? I don't say anything, though. This is all going on inside my head. I don't say anything. My parents don't know anything about alcoholism. My parents aren't alcoholic. And although I have two alcoholic children, but they're not alcoholic. And so I suck it up. They drive me down the road. And there's this sign that says, Gosnell, a bridge back. And here's this chatter. Sarcasm and nastiness. Bridge back to what? That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. What the hell does that mean? I go in. They deposit me. I go to a rehab. Now, I've been sober for 3 days now. I didn't have any physical addiction, so that was the longest 3 days in rehab because there was nothing they could do for me except wait for the 3 days to put me in program. And they were like, God, you're a pleasure. So I go in, and it's January. I go in January 8th, 1988. And it was awful. Love my dad. My dad loves me. I call my dad, and I say to my dad, it's a terrible place. It's awful. You need to come get me, Dad. Please, you can't leave me. Daddy is a terrible place. It's a terrible place. Please come. And my dad hangs up the phone, and he's going to come get me. And my brother calls. Like, talk about God in your life. My brother calls, or this is how they tell the story. Maybe they call my brother. That's how they tell the story. And he says, we got to go get your sister. It's a terrible place. She says, it's terrible. We need to go get your sister. And he's like, oh, no. That's what my brother said. Oh, no, no, no. He said, you need to leave her there. Just leave her. And my dad said, but she says it's a terrible place. And my brother's like, oh, no, 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 no. Leave her right where she should be. And so they left me. My father left me. And God, my father would have done anything for me, but he left me. It was probably the hardest thing he ever did. So the first week there, I was playing with the boys, you know, doing all the things I wasn't supposed to be doing and distracting myself with boys and anything but, you know, treatment. And they looked at me and they said, if you don't smarten up, we're going to ask you to leave. And, you know, my parents had paid. And it was January of 88, and they'd let us walk around the building. Here I am, 25, walking around a building in the snow, and I used to think to myself, if my insurance company had paid for this, I'd be gone, because the gin mill's right at the end of the street. I would not have stayed. And that was my second blessing, like God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. Like my insurance company not paying, because I would have left. My parents paid. I stayed because it was their money. And they worked so hard for that, and I just couldn't make myself leave and do that to my parents. I just couldn't. I owed them that. So the second week, I sort of suck it up, and I start to unload some stuff, like some big stuff. And I just sort of vomit it, like the biggest thing that's like the biggest stumbling block for me. I just finally vomit that out there. And people were like, that's the biggest thing? And I felt relief. For the first time in my life, some of that enormous shame and guilt, I left there with strangers, and I felt a little bit of relief, and I got a little bit of hope. Again, AA was an hour and a half. They came in. It was the longest hour and a half of my life. I was beside myself, and I hated it, but I made some really good friends, and this is how sick I am. So there are two women in there. They're like in their late 70s, 78, 79. It was Ginny and Ruth. Ruth was mean as a snake. Ginny was one of those people you want to be your grandmother, and Ruth was just viciously mean. And so I leave there, and I say to my mother, there are two 78-year-old women in there. What the hell? They're going to die soon anyway. What the hell would they want to get sober for now? And my mother says to me, like, thoroughly disgusted with me. She's like, it's not the quantity of time they have left, Linda. It's the quality of the time they have left. And I'm like, oh, damn. Like, those things just didn't even register with me. Like, I was just so sick. So I hear things like, you know, they're talking to me. Like, one of the groups, the guy gets on his knees, drops down in front of me on his knees. And says a prayer. Now, I'm embarrassed for him. This is where my head's at. I'm like, get up, man. Have some self-respect. I'm like, I was totally horrified about, like, this guy drops to his... I'm like, that's really private. You should not be doing that in public. And all this chatter's going on in my head, and I'm just, like, beside myself ashamed for him. And they would say to me, like, you need to get on your knees and ask for help. And I'm like... And I did. My hand shoots up, and I go... You mean figuratively, right? You don't mean literally you want me to get on my knees. And it's figuratively. And they're like, no, Linda, we mean literally. And I'm like, oh, no, no. Because I came in with no God. I was godless. And I had a real hard time with the spiritual part of this program for years and years and years. So anyway, he's doing that. I'm again horrified. And everything they asked me to do was totally foreign to the way I was living. So it was very hard for me. So I complete my little program like a good doobie, and the only two people that come to see me are my parents, get this, and the alcohol counselor who was assigned to me from the courts for my second drunk driving. God bless that man. And I had violated probation again by getting drunk and going to treatment, and they wanted to send me to prison, and he stuck up for me. I'm like, what sense does that make? I'm getting treatment, yet because I broke my probation, they want to send me to prison. He squared that away for me, and so... He was a blessing. So this is what this man does for me. I get out on a Saturday afternoon. He takes me to my first meeting on the street. And what I hear is the same bloody group that had come in that was as boring the first time I heard him as the second time I heard him on the street. And I was beside myself. And so he gets a meeting list book. But we have a book. Like, we have a ton of meetings. And he circles every day a meeting I should go to. And he says, kid, if you want it, I'm 25, you go get it. And he said, I want you to go to Brockton High Sunday morning. I don't believe he was alcoholic. I don't think I've ever seen the man at the meeting. I just think he worked with us. And I did. And the next morning I got up and I went to it was Brockton High School Sunday morning meeting. Don't remember. Three or four significant things happened there. I walk in and this gentleman comes up to me and says, you must be new. I'm like, what is it, stamped across my forehead? It could be like that look on your face, like that angry, I'm here, I hate it, but what do you mean? And I'm like, how does he know I'm new? And he was very kind. And he's like, and I'm like, yep, I just got out of rehab yesterday. This is my second meeting. So he says, oh, I want you to meet somebody. I'm like, yep, nope, I'm good. And so it's like he takes me over this woman. Her name was Anne-Marie. He's like, this is Anne-Marie? Anne-Marie, this is Linda. She's really new. I think she should be a sponsor. Now, this is the dialogue in my head. Oh, no. She's got Coke bottle glasses. She truly has a mullet. She's just nothing I would want to ever have anything to do. And I'm like, oh, no. No, no, no. And I'm like, hey, nice to meet you. I think I'm going to go sit over there. And I was very polite. I'm always polite, but what goes on in my head is never polite. I go sit down. As you know, I have no license now. I get on the bus. Who the hell's on the bus? Anne-Marie. I've been taking that bus every day for a year because I have no license. I never noticed this woman before in my life. Anne-Marie gets on the bus. I'm like, seriously? But before that happens, the only other thing I remember about that meeting was Jimmy Pirelli. I was 19 days sober. Jimmy Pirelli got his 19-year medallion, and I said, baloney. That's not what I said, though. I won't cuss. But I said, that's just absolute nonsense. I don't believe it for a second. I don't believe it for 1 minute. And that's the only thing I remember. I don't remember what anybody said. I remember me, Anne Marie. I remember the guy that thought I was new, and I remember Jimmy getting his thing. And then I see Anne Marie the next day on the bus. So, begrudgingly, because I'm just this most disagreeable young child. I am disagreeable. And I say to her, oh, how do you find a sponsor? Now, Emery is, like, plugged into AA like you would not believe. She's, like, into the grapevine. She works in the business. Whatever. She comes in the next day with this grapevine article. I read it, and I'm like, holy moly, I'll be drunk if I'd wait for all of that stuff. Will you be my sponsor? And she said yes. Now, Emery saved my life. And so she sat on that bus with me Monday through Friday, every day, from the day I walked out and I saw her on that bus reading the big book with me. And every day, painstakingly, let me tell you, painstakingly, I proved and I disputed every line in that big book and why it didn't apply to me. She had the patience of a Job. I just didn't want to be here. I just wanted to be different. And she would tell me, terminally unique. And she would tell me the same things over and over again, like, half measures avail us nothing, Linda. Until you let go, absolutely, the result is no, Linda. She would tell me things like, Jesus, she was just always telling me the same things all the time. So she had the patience of Job. But she taught me how to stay sober. She gave me basic ideas, like things like, we have package stores that sell, you know, lottery tickets, gum, anything in a package store, which you guys don't have here. So she would be like, you can't go to the liquor store anymore to buy a pack of gum, a pack of cigarettes, or a lottery ticket. You have no right to be in there. You can't go into the bar rooms that you drank at because you have to see Joe, John, and Sally. Because you have no right to be there anymore. I don't want you to drink, you know, take NyQuil. I drink NyQuil. She's like, it's like 60% alcohol. I'm like, really? Huh, I didn't know that. She told me, and I've never taken NyQuil. And then she told me I shouldn't drink vanilla. I'm like, who the hell drinks vanilla? I had no idea that was full of alcohol. I was like, who the hell drinks vanilla? I'm like, okay, scratch that off my list. And then she would say, call me before you drink, not after you drink. She would call me, she would tell me things like, you can't dry off with a wet towel. And I would go, huh, what does that mean? And I was too proud to ask. And she always talked in riddles. And I'd be like, what does that mean? And she said, you can't get sober with people that don't know how to get sober. And you need to hang out with people in sobriety that have time. And let me tell you, if you have no time, my experience with that, it's really uncomfortable hanging out with people that have time. They have a life. You're just biting your fingernails. I'm just, like, trying not to implode on the seat and sit down there and be still. And they're telling me that I have to listen to them talk about their lives. And I'm like, and be jealous and feel like, geez, I wish that would be me. And have nothing to contribute to the conversation. Because all I know is the mess that my life is and how I can drink and make it better. And that was really hard. But when I was about 13 years sober, I understood what that meant. There were two guys that were in a treatment facility. I knew them really well. They came to our group. They had reason to go off to go visit somebody's father, one of the boys' fathers, and they got on the train to go see the guy's father, and one looked at the other and said, I feel like getting high together, high, and they just did. They had no defense. Not one of them said, let's call our sponsor. Not one of them said, let's return to the treatment center. They were living at the Salvation Army. Not one of them said, let's just go to a meeting. They just went and got high, and one overdosed and almost died. They didn't find him for 36 hours. So can't hang out with wet towel. You can't dry off with a wet towel. That became very apparent at 13 years. See, I'm a slow learner. And I'm working with a young girl, right now in sobriety. And I was saying, like, AA has changed. We're reading about the presses, how things change in AA. And I was saying, in the years I've been around, like, AA has changed a lot. I'm like, you never hear the slogans anymore. So I'm like, do you even know what slogans are? And she's like, no. And so I'm going through the slogans with her, and I'm thinking, like, I've forgotten them because it's been so long since I've heard them. Like, I was looking up some of them, like, one day at a time, easy does it, which I know. First things first, which is what I live by. The hardest one I ever had to do was live and let live. I couldn't do that to save my soul. You know, I was in everybody's business, and I wanted to, you know, live and let live was tough. If you weren't doing the right thing and I was doing the right thing and we had the same result, what was the point of me doing the right thing? That was how I thought for a lot of years. And I wanted a reward for everything. You know, if I'm being good, then I need a reward. And if you're not being good and you're getting the same result, that's just not fair. And my sponsor cleared that up for me, and he said, could you live with yourself if you behave like that? We didn't have that argument ever again. And that's what it is. What can I live with? Who do I want to be today? Not what you are, not what I think you are, but who do I want to be today? And what can I live with today? What kind of human being do I want to be? And I don't want to be the girl I brought in here. So she told me constant vigilance is the price you pay. And I'm like, again, it's a half sentence. For what? I'm like, what's the rest of that? Where's the predicate there? It's constant vigilance is what? And, you know, I was about 8 years sober, and I'm driving around, and I'm not happy. I'm in a relationship I shouldn't be in sober. I'm not as connected to AA as I should be. I'm not telling people some things I should be telling. And I've been dreaming about drinking, and I'm going to drink tequila at Maple Lounge on a bar stool. And in my dream, I'm thinking, like, I got to get by the guilt. I just got to figure out how to get by the guilt. Here I am on a Sunday evening. Now I'm awake, and these thoughts are coming along. And I'm thinking, like, I'm like, oh, my God, I'm going to drink. And I went to immediately Hungry, Angry, Lonely, Tired. I was starving. I stopped and got a pizza. I have a big book always in my car. It was in my trunk. I got that out while I ate my pizza. I was terribly lonely, and I went to my meeting that I was supposed to go, and I told people, like, I'm 8 years sober, and I'm going to drink. I'm a mess. My life is a mess at 8 years sober. And I got reconnected in AA again, which you shouldn't have to, but, you know, I kind of strayed. I always went, but I didn't go as often as I should, and I didn't do all the things I should have. But for me, constant vigilance is the price I pay, meaning that I have to constantly be vigilant about the noise that's going on between my ears. That's how I ended that predicate. That's what works for me. I don't know. You know, and there were so many things I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that helped my life that I can't even begin to tell you. I was about 2 years sober, and my mom said, I don't know who that girl is, but my daughter's back. That brought tears to my eyes, you know. That's what alcohol did to me. It made me into somebody my mother didn't even know or recognize anymore. And I have a daughter that is suffering from this illness, and my mother would say to me all the time, I don't like you very much, but I love you. And I'd be like, that's not very nice. And I can relate to that because I love my daughter very much, but I don't like her very much. I don't like the human being she's becoming or has become. I don't like, she's not the girl I recognize anymore. And I understand what it is to not like somebody but to still love them. I love my daughter more than anything, but she's not very likable. And neither was I. Quite frankly, in the throes of addiction, I am not very likable. In early sobriety, I was not very likable. And so somewhere in my early sobriety, I decide that my life isn't going to change. I'm going to have a baby. I'm 5 months sober. This is a decision I make. I told the man I'm seeing. It's a conscious decision. I didn't just get pregnant by accident. It was a conscious decision. And I say to him, I want to have a baby, and if you don't, you need to do something. 5 months sober, I'm pregnant. 14 months sober, I'm delivering this baby girl that I love more than anything. 17 months sober, I'm drinking. And my sponsor said to me before I picked up a drink, you need to go home. I was terrified. I was loaded with this fear. Like, I didn't know what to do with this young girl. And I can't ask for help. I'm still dying. I can't ask for help. And I was too proud to say to my mom, I need help. I don't know what to do. And she was great. She'd come over, but I just couldn't do it. And so I was out. So that happened in, like, May of 89. August 8th. 1989, I put down a drink, and I've been continuously sober. But in that three-month period, I had a black eye. I had fingerprints around my throat. I had sat in thousands of AA meetings in that 17 months, and I heard how many women had lost their children due to alcoholism and drug addiction. And I didn't want to lose my daughter. That's not how I was raised. That's not the future I wanted her to have. And I started getting involved in other things, and what happened was, every Thursday my mom would take my daughter, and she said, so you can go to meetings and go out, and that's my contribution to for you getting married. That was like at 27. I didn't get married until I was 48, so my poor mother. So she would take her every Thursday, but this particular Thursday night I was out doing whatever I was doing, and I was using other substances besides drinking, and I walk in my home, because everybody's got keys to my home, and my mother's there with my daughter, and my daughter was sick, and my mother couldn't comfort her. She just wouldn't. And so my mother took one look at me and said, what is wrong with you? I was like, white as a ghost, white as a sheet. And anyway, I'm like, I'm fine. She leaves me my baby girl. I hold my baby, Amanda's her name, Amanda, and she goes to sleep. And my sponsor was all into AA tapes. And, you know, I'm doing a chemical that's keeping me up for days. And I throw in this AA tape, and it says, if you don't like, this is what it says in my head. I've never heard it again, but it said to me, if you don't like what you're doing, stop doing what you're doing. And I put down a drink and a drug right from that day forward, and I haven't felt it necessary to pick it up. I was done. And when I came in the second time, I was really, I don't care what you would have told me to do. I had a good base, but I did everything over again. And my life started to take off again. My mother didn't know. And then I told her. Her first clue was when I had the black eye, it was actually a torn cornea, and I took the prescription for narcotics because I wouldn't. That was her first clue, and that I was probably not on the straight and narrow. And I got really involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it has saved my life. And my daughter's never seen me drink. She's 27. I love AA. I love AA. I did a lot of kitchen AA back home. People would come to my house. You know, I'd leave my house unlocked. I'd get home. People would be on my porch. I'd get home. There'd be notes. People would come to see me, or they'd be like, I came to see you. You weren't here. Played with the dog. Ate chocolate chip cookies on the couch. Call me when you get home. You know, and I loved AA. AA saved my life. It turned me into something I thought I never thought I would be. You know, I'm proud of who I am today. But as long as I've been around, things change, and I change, and I find, like, I have new struggles, and, like, what's my life like today? My mom's coming to see me. She adores me. I adore my mother. She's coming on Wednesday, and my biggest issue in sobriety right now is perfectionism. Not that I didn't have it before, but it's, like, it keeps smacking me in the face to the point that it's crippling me, and, like, I want to be the perfect daughter. Like, my mom has a house that looks like nobody lives in it. Because that's what she does all day long. She cleans her house. I work full-time. I work more than full-time. I go to meetings. My life is full. My house does not look like her house. And I want my mother to want to be in my home. And I'm, like, crazy trying to get my house perfect and to be the perfect daughter and have the things she wants in my house. And I said to her today, I just can't pull it together, Mom. I swear to you that your bathroom and your room will be spotless, but I just can't pull it together before you get here. And she's like, it's okay, honey. It just don't even worry about it. We'll just do it when I get there. And you know, and that's hard for me, you know. And to say, like, I just can't do it all, you know. And I made this huge blunder at work recently. And again, about being human. And I swear, God is just kind of slapping me in the face with, like, I'm just not perfect. I'm just going to make mistakes. And I feel like saying, okay, we can stop with the lesson. And it's been really difficult for me. It's been really, really difficult. And my, you know, and the problem with that for me is that self-talk. Like, I get into, like, you know, I'm a bad mom, or I'm a bad daughter, or I'm not the best employee. And I still get into that flight, like, I should quit my job. And my boss is like, she extended so much grace when this thing. I mean, there were small things, and then there were very large things. It was a very large mistake I made. And she was very measured. She didn't say a thing. And she put her head down, and then she left for a while, and she came back. And I didn't say much. She just said, what happened? And I said, and this is another thing I learned. Like, I didn't lie. I don't ever lie. But, I mean, I just didn't have an excuse for her. I said, anything I tell you would be an excuse. I made a mistake. I can tell you what I thought when I calculated the date. I calculated the date wrong. But I don't have any defense. So to say anything to me would be like an excuse, except that I'm really sorry. And, she's like, it's okay. We'll fix it. And I felt sick for days. I was sick for days. And my sponsor's like, God doesn't think those things of you. Why do you have to keep thinking? You're just human. Do you think God thinks that of you? I'm like, I don't know, but it's killing me here. So she was really, really kind. Really kind. And so we did fix it. But it was kind of like I was thinking, like, I just want to be perfect. I can't. I just can't. and that's tough for me. And I have a daughter that doesn't want to, you know, get sober, and her life is scary. It's quite frankly terrifying. And but that's, and I try to, and sometimes I feel miserably. I try to stay out of that arena, and I'm telling you, sometimes I feel miserably. And that's the one thing I guess I want to say. Life happens. My dad died, but I was the daughter I wanted to be, and I helped my mom bury my dad. I went home all the time to be with my dad before he died. When he died, my mom didn't want to plan the funeral or have anything to do but attend, and I took care of all of that thing. And if I was drinking, I couldn't have done that. And life is going to happen. You know, jobs are going to get lost. Parents are going to die. Kids may have this illness or not. You know, kids may be what we want them to be or not. And then there's joy. You know, there's all sorts of joy. I mean, I have a relationship with my mother that I never thought I would have. I'm sober, and alcohol is not the solution today. It's not the solution. It's just that I have to figure out a way to live with whatever my discomfort is today. You know, and sometimes it takes a while to get through the discomfort for me to figure out what the solution is for the discomfort, you know, and it's more meetings, it's God, you know, it's helping others, and just forgiving myself. Just forgiving myself for being human and knowing that I'm flawed and I can't help that, you know. But overall, I'm a good person today, which I wasn't. If I tell you I'm going to be there, I'm going to be there. If I say I'm going to help you, I'm going to help you. And if I can't, I'm going to call and explain what happened. You know, I didn't have those abilities. I didn't have any of those abilities. I can put somebody ahead of me. When my daughter came along, my parents thought it was the worst decision I ever made. My daughter was a couple years old, and my mother said, "Oh, my God, that was the best thing you ever did." I mean, my daughter is amazing. I love that kid. And I loved being mom. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. You know, you just don't know. And that's the other thing about life. You know, people tell me things like choices I make are bad, and they end up being just fine. They're just fine. But they think they're terrible. And my mom's like, "I was really wrong about that." And I'm like, "That's okay. That's all right." You know, my sponsor used to have this saying, and she used to say to me, "You just don't know that you don't know." And I would find that terribly insulting. Like, what do you think, I'm an idiot? I was national honor. And I remember thinking, when I set out to have my daughter, this is what I said to myself: how hard is it going to be to raise a child on your own? Well, talk about you don't know that you don't know. That became a very significant statement in my life. I didn't know that I didn't know. Raising a child, you need a village. And my parents were there. And although Amanda's father was never part of her life, his parents have always been there for her. And, you know, we did everything together. My life turned out okay. But, like, I didn't know that I didn't know. And there are a lot of things I don't know that I don't know. But that sentence became very significant at that moment. And it's extremely difficult raising a child on your own. AA has changed my life. I don't have that craziness going on in my head anymore, you know. I have friends of depth and weight. When I got here, I didn't have a single human connection with another living soul other than my family because they kept it, not because I did, you know. I don't feel alone today, but I sometimes feel a great sadness. You know, when I got here, they told me sadness and joy could live in your heart at the same time, and I said that was rubbish, and that's true. I have great sadness about my daughter's life and my daughter, but I have great joy. You can have both, and I thought there was no way that those two things can live inside your soul and your heart. And they can. And you can be a great life. And the last thing I'll say is I've been working on, the one thing I love about AA is one of the slogans was, for me, that worked for me was fake it till you make it. And people hate that up here or in Virginia. But to me, act as if is the same thing, because if you're acting, you're faking. But this is the part about that is that it works for that sentence may not have any meaning for them, but this one does. So we find the words of the words that work or resonate with us. You know what I mean? And so for me, like meditation. So the word that resonates I found for me is mindfulness. I'm trying to be mindful, which just means right here, right now. People say that, oh, that doesn't mean anything to me, but it does now. Like I'm trying to be present. I'm trying to be mindful when I'm speaking to somebody, like actually looking at them and listening to them, because, you know, sometimes I'm really not. And I'm trying to, you know, to meditate and be mindful about what I'm thinking and where I'm at when I'm meditating. And so that's like the key word for me. Like I have a bell that goes off at work, and it's like it goes off like every hour, and it's a mindful bell. Like I just breathe 3 times, and I'm going to be mindful about where I'm at, what I'm doing. And that's where I'm residing now, is trying to be in the moment and trying to be mindful of the things in my life and mindful of the people who love me and mindful of the things that are important to them and giving them my time. And it's interesting because this is a big thing for me. I know when I'm talking and they're not listening to me, it irritates the 11 but Jesus out of me now. They're just somewhere else. Like, I can see that now, and I can see how it must have felt for people I did that to. So I'm trying to be mindful. And so my life has really changed. It's amazing. It is amazing. And if you're new, my experience was it was a little bit difficult in the beginning. And if you're young, it's difficult. I was 25 when I got here. You know, I thought my life was over. At my 15-year anniversary, my sponsor gave me this medallion that said, with my anniversary date on it, 8889, and he wrote on it, "This is the day my life began." And it was. That's my birthday. That was the date my life began, was 8889, when I came with you guys. And I allowed you to love me when I couldn't love myself. And I allowed you to take control of my life. And I allowed you to show me how to work these steps in my life, although I didn't talk about them. And I allowed you to love me in all my disagreeableness and just show me the way. And I can't thank you enough. And quite frankly, my family can't thank you enough. Thank you. Mm-hmm.